1986 Productions.
We met in the springtime when blossoms unfold. The pastures were green and the meadows were gold. Our love was in flower as summer grew on. Her love, like the leaves, now have withered and gone.
Hey there, boys and girls. Cheyenne here, with my bottle of Boone's in hand. I bring to you episode number 2 of It Burns When I Pee. I'd like to say hey to all my fans out there. Thanks for all the feedback you guys have sent to me. A special shout out to Aaron. I might take you up on your offer. Anyways, getting back to my job, it's time for It Burns When I Pee from Get Your Hank On Studios. It Burns When I Pee is brought to you by Section86.com. And now, here's your host, Blake Clayton.
All right, welcome everybody to episode 2 of It Burns When I Pee. It's the only podcast around that talks about real country music and all that pop-ass bullshit that you hear on the FM stations nowadays. I got a huge show for you. We got an interview with Jake Penrod. He's my boy down in Texas, and he's got a new album coming out at the end of the summer. We're going to interview him. We're going to listen to one of his songs called The Blazing Fires of Hell, which he wrote, and our buddy Joey Alcorn did a demo of. And at the end of the interview, we're going to listen to another song of Jake's called When I Was Dreaming. I also want to go through some of the Hank Williams III tour dates. His summer tour is kicking off. I want to let you all know about that. I want to take a few minutes to talk about our friends at TakeCountryBack.com. They were really instrumental in getting the word out on our first podcast, and we want to pimp them out a little bit. I also want to give you the dial-in number so you guys can start leaving messages or comments for the show. And I also want to spend a few minutes talking about my boys UGT. That's United Groove Theory. They're a local band here in Central Illinois, and they put on a great show, so I want to give them a little bit of props. So anyway, let's start things off with a voicemail that we got the other day from our good friend Alabama. She's out there in G-Town, Illinois. So, Alabama, this one's for you, dear.
Hey, we're by your house. Are you home yet? We're going to Steak and Shake. Just so I call you and tell you. Thank you guys for coming tonight. We're going to Steak and Shake. Hello? Oh, bye. Love you guys. Bye.
All right, everyone, and as promised, this is Joey Alcorn singing The Blazing Fires of Hell, which was written by our guest, Jake Penrod.
He loved her, and nothing in the world could change his mind. He knew she was the one with whom he'd spend eternity. She loved him, and she knew that she would never find a man as good as he was, who could make her so happy. And they'd go through the blazing fires of hell for one another, side by side in each other's arms they'd dwell. Arm in arm they'd face it all together, with a love burning wilder than the blazing fires of hell. She loved him, so how could she forget herself that night? Betray him with a stranger she hardly even knew. She told him, and his world was suddenly turned upside down. For how could she who loved him turn out to be untrue? left her. And in his misery, he bought a gun. He took his life just to forget the one he loved so well. She found him. She didn't have to read his note to understand. With the same gun that he used, she followed him to hell. And they'd go through the blazing fires of hell for one another, side by side in each other's arms they'd dwell. Arm in arm they'd face it all together, with a love burning wilder than the blazing fires of hell.
Okay, welcome back, everybody, and we're here with our guest for episode two. His name is Jake Penrod. Jake, how's it going?
Pretty good, man. Yourself?
Doing all right, doing all right. So, Jake, I think we should start out by kind of telling people where you're from.
Well, I was born in Tyler, Texas, and grew up pretty much around that area. Until I was five, I lived in a little ranch around outside of Athens, and after... I guess I was five or six. We moved to a little town called Brownsboro, and I've lived here pretty much since then. I'm 22 now, so been here most of my life.
22. So at what age did you start playing the guitar and performing?
Let's see. I got my first guitar. I was about 9 years old in the fourth grade. It was a Christmas present from my dad. And I learned probably, I think, two chords, C and G. And so everything I did from there until I was about 11 was either C or G, but I didn't quite get the concept of changing chords. And I've actually got some recordings of me as a little kid howling, completely butchering all these songs, playing them one chord over and over. And I think by the time I was 11, I kind of figured out, you know, how chords and everything work. I wouldn't say I really was able to play the guitar really until I was about 12. I mastered that F chord, which is a pretty big deal when you're a kid with small hands playing guitar. But didn't really perform a lot. You know, I would sing around the house. I was like a closet singer. I didn't want anybody to know this was a hobby I had.
Right.
And I was a real bashful kid. It didn't take much to embarrass me. But my senior year of high school, I guess I was 17, and this guy, I joined this guy's band as his keyboard player, and we'd do some shows, and they'd let me do a song or two each show we did, and I'll never forget, the first song I did in front of the band was Tuesday's Gone, that's Williams Jr., and it pretty much sucked. It wasn't good. I mean, it was the first time I'd ever sang in a crowd. This was a crowd of all bikers, too. We were at a biker rally.
Oh, yeah, so that's a good place to start off, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was, I guess I did all right. I mean, you could tell what the song was, but I think the very next night we played a private party, and I did some older, like, Hank Williams stuff, and that's when I really started getting a reaction from people, and I was like, you know, this is cool. This might be something I want to do.
Right.
And after graduation that same year, I entered a talent contest at our senior lock-in, sang Jambalaya from the Bayou, and won first place. And like all my friends, nobody knew I sang. I was always just this scrawny, dorky kid that was, you know, in science class, you know, that everybody knew me, but not a whole lot of people really talked to me. It was like I was the dork kid, but it was cool to know me.
Right.
And so I blew everybody away in this contest. And the reaction I got from my own peers, you know, in high school, the people that I thought couldn't stand me, you know, when they all jump up and scream, this was probably the loudest sound I ever heard in our high school gym.
That's awesome.
It got to me. I was like, you know what? I think I can really do this. And so after I started college, you know, a couple of my friends were kind of encouraging me. They'd heard a little recording that I made at the house. And like, you know, you should try to get on some of these little Opry's that are around here. And so I auditioned at the Gladewater Opry in Gladewater, Texas. And they liked me. And so I guess I started really performing once every other month. There in Gladewater in about March of 2004. And I've been doing pretty much the same thing, you know, doing these little operas around East Texas, North Texas, mostly playing with house bands. Every now and then I'll get a little private gig somewhere.
Sure.
But I've been doing that mostly operas. Being in college and everything, don't have a lot of time to do much else. But
sure.
As long as I keep performing, I'm doing all right. But, yeah, somewhere around the time I was 17, 18 was then when I really started performing.
And it was the infamous talent show that seems to be, you know, the way a lot of artists' stories go where, you know, they enter a talent contest or something, and next thing you know, that's where they find their hits, so.
Yeah, and it was like, it was spur of the moment. And what actually got me to do it is the guy that, who was the front man in the band that I was in, he did some, like, pre-entertainment for the talent show. And I'm like, well, I can't let this guy showboat up there. I can do this, too. So it was like a last-minute sign-up, and they let me do it. But I wouldn't change anything. It was awesome.
It was meant to be that way. That's the way it goes, you know? So who are some of your musical influences that you have?
Aside from the obvious ones, like, you know, Hank Williams, Webb Pierce, Farron Young, Johnny Cash is a big one, mostly because that was probably one of the first, I guess, old school singers I was exposed to. My dad had a ton of old Johnny Cash LPs, and so that's kind of probably where I got my taste for older country.
Sure.
One of my biggest influences would probably have to be my dad. He bought me my first guitar and showed me three or four chords, and I kind of took off from there. And one that would probably surprise a lot of people would be my older brother. And if he ever hears this, he won't let me live it down. But now, he got a guitar, I guess, probably Christmas of 1990. I was a little bitty kid. And I just remember watching my brother play this guitar all the time, and I was like, man, I wish I could do that. You know, I want to be like my big brother.
Sure.
And so I guess it was probably another 5 years or so, I finally got my own guitar, and I was like, you know, and then, of course, I learned a lot quicker than they thought I would, and so it's like those that I say I looked up to, they're looking up at me now like, man, teach me that, show me that again.
There you go.
my dad, he was in a band back in the 60s in high school, and I don't know, I always wanted to be kind of like that, just get my own band going. So, Dad, he inspired me a lot. My biggest influence, probably, you know, the well-known artist, but obviously Hank Williams, if you listen to any of my songs. The writing style is really similar. And my voice, they say I sound just like him. I can argue that until I'm blue in the face. I've listened to him over and over and over, and I can tell anybody I don't sound that much like him, but there's a lot of similarity. And then I look like him, which is scary.
Right. You know, when I first met you or first saw you at the Hank Williams Museum for the New Year's Eve show, you know, when you first walked into my room, I was like, you know, kind of stuttered for a minute, you know, because you do have the same characteristics, really tall, you know, slanky, and got the same kind of face. And that's when I heard you sing, I was like, this guy's good. It was really a good show that you put on. And then I really enjoyed when you and Joey came out and sang a couple of songs together. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was awesome. We were talking backstage, and both of us, we have another a common hero. And I didn't get really turned on to this guy until a couple of years ago. I had couple of Hank 3 albums, and he was talking about Wayne the Train Hancock. And I was like, well, who is this guy? So I found some of his stuff, and I'm like, wow, you know, here's a guy today playing country music the way it should be. And so he's probably one of my latest influences. But, yeah, Joey and I were talking backstage there, and talking about Wayne. And I was like, well, we should do a couple of his songs together. So Wayne Hancock, he's probably a big one for me. Out of the other instruments that I play, I've picked up the fiddle, kind of. I have to say, Chubby Wise, probably a big influence. You know, the guy's style. I mean, you wouldn't think a fat man would play a fiddle like that, but he's pretty awesome. And then, let's see. I play a lot of lap steel, and I cheat. I use a tuning that you're not, that's, I think I invented it. But it's the only way that I can imitate Don Helms. But I'd say probably, he's probably one of my biggest influences. I've been able to meet him, I think, two or three times.
Sure, and for people who don't...
It's always awesome when you can meet one of your heroes.
Oh, definitely, and for a lot of people that don't know, that Don Helms was one of the original Drifting Cowboys and that played with Hank Williams. So, you know, that was... He's a well known in the music world. So, do you have a album out right now, or do you have any recordings that you've done that are?
I do have my first album is called Now You Know. It was recorded summer of 2004. I've still got maybe 100 or so copies of that thing left, and I'm working on a new one now. Let's see, the title is When I Was Dreaming, and I think I have sent you the title track to that.
Sure, and we're going to be playing that right after the interview. And so, are you trying to get, you know, possibly signed to a label, or are you kind of taking the independent route and kind of trying to... you know, scrounge up the cash to do it and distribute it yourself, or?
I'm liking the independent thing. My problem with getting signed to a label is that there's going to be somebody else telling me what to do. And I'm not like a hard-ass rebel or anything, but I know what I want to hear, and I don't think that somebody else is going to have the same vision that I do when I come up with some music and say, you know, this is me. You know, there's nobody else that can tell me what me is, you know. And so, maybe, you know, it would help financially a whole lot if a label could pick me up. But I'm doing everything completely on my own. All the tracks on each of the songs I'm recording myself, I'm doing guitar, bass, steel, everything. And wow. So, everything that I want to hear is all there. And that's one of the things I kind of worry about if I were to get signed to a label, is that, you know, all these things that I hear in my head might not be there because there'll be, you know, other guys saying, well, here's what this should sound like. But, you know, I think if it does come to that, somebody actually, you know, sees something in me that they want to, you know, help me out with and actually sign me to something, I'm definitely going to, you know, keep my guard up and make sure, you know, none of my original ideas go to waste, because I've got a lot of music in my head, just getting it out there. Got to make sure it stays.
Exactly. You know, and like you had mentioned, like, you know, you're not one of the hard-ass rebels, and, you know, of course, the first person that comes to mind is Hank Williams III, who, you know, from day one has cursed the record labels and really has been one of the most vocal and, you know, one of those people that follows through. You know,
right.
he's really pushed. You know, he had, you know, the first album he had came out, and, you know, to me it was a good album, although you look at that album and then now, you know, it wasn't really him, and, you know, he almost disowns that album altogether except for, like, one or two songs. And then the second album was a little bit more him, and I know that he, you know, it was almost two to three years before he actually could release his latest album, because he fought so hard, because record label says, no, you're going to do this, and he's like, no, I'm going to do this. So, and once you sign your name on the dotted line, it takes a lot to get that that contract broke. So,
oh, yeah.
So like you said, keeping, you know, the independent roots and being able to make all the decisions, and like you said, for each instrument, you know exactly how you want it to sound, and you don't have to worry about these four guys that walk in out of nowhere that are, you know, session band guys and, you know, kind of ruin the integrity of what you're doing.
Absolutely. I got a whole lot of respect for Mr. Williams, you know, because he's like, this is a guy that should have had the world. I mean, you know, here he's like the spitting image of Hank Sr., and the guy could be just rolling millions of dollars, but he's got his own beliefs, you know. He's like, he's not going to be some fake standing there living off his granddad, you know. He's going to do his own thing, and I have to respect that because, I mean, he's keeping it real, giving up who knows what the guy could have if he went along with Nashville's scheme and, you know, the reincarnation of Hank Williams and everything. And, you know, he's doing what he wants to do, and that's awesome.
Exactly, because I know that, you know, when his first album came out, you know, that's all that the advertisements were, you know, the punkabilly grandson of Hank Williams, you know, senior.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, you hear a lot of stories about kids that have grown up, you know, with parents that have been famous in the music world, and it's got to be tough, and, you know, a lot of them just succumb to, hey, whatever you want to do with me to get the name, but, you know, he stuck by what he believes in, and, you know, he and you got to respect it. You know, there's a lot of times we were just like, oh, man, just, you know, just to hear, you know, to get the album out, just do what, you know, half of what they want you to do, but, you know, but when you do finally hear the album, you're like, you know what, it was worth waiting, It's I've met him a couple times, and he's a real cool guy, and I think he's a lot of misunderstood too. But you know, that's the same way with Wayne, I think, as well. Is, you know, Wayne has, you know, doesn't need to, you know, have big sellouts and go to big arenas. I mean, that guy's playing the traditional, you know, country swing, and he's ripping it up every night, and he'll play for, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours until he can't play anymore. So, where can fans find, get a hold of the album that you had, the first album you had, and when do you see the next album being ready to, you know, send out?
Well, my first album, you know, is available exclusively through me. You know, they can contact me on my page on MySpace. I'm usually selling probably about, you know, $12.
Sure.
And that's, you know, shipping, handling, all that stuff, you know.
Sure.
And so, but yeah, if they, you know, contact me through MySpace, you know, give me an address, you know, I can send one out to them. The new album, I'm hoping it will be done by the end of this summer. First, I said, well, sometime maybe in the summer, then it became the middle of the summer, and I'm looking at probably the end of the summer. A lot of it is finding time to do all of it, since I'm playing all the instruments on this thing. It's, and, you know, working this job. It's taken me a lot of time. I've got several songs finished. And I keep writing new stuff that I'm like, well, maybe this should go on there. And, you know, I had a plan. And, you know, I knew exactly what I wanted. And then I write a new song, and I'm like, well, this is too good. I got to put this on the album now.
Exactly. It's like you get a box set already before you even get the first album, you know, the second album even completed.
I may steal Hank 3's idea and do a double, you know. Put some just guitar demos on one CD and put an actual album on the other CD and do it like that.
Exactly. Just don't put like 45 minutes worth of sound effects, you know, in between.
I didn't like the pig squealing and the train. Actually, the train scared me because I was in my truck listening to it, and I hear the horn blowing, and I'm looking for a train.
Exactly.
It took me about a minute and a half to realize this is on the CD.
Exactly.
So, you know, I don't want scare people or cause any wrecks.
There you go. But I know that Joey Alcorn did a demo of one of your songs, The Blazing Fires of Hell, and he's got it posted on his MySpace, and I really enjoyed the song, and I was kind of wanting to know what inspired you to write that song. I mean, is there a specific event, or where it was a specific subject you were just trying to, you know, capture?
Well, for those who are familiar with the song, it's about a guy who his woman cheats on him. Comes and tells him, and his world falls apart, and he can't handle it, so he kills himself. I don't know, I've always liked writing about real stuff, you see so much sugar-coated crap, and, you know, they beat around everything, and they don't get to the point. And I'm like, well, put it this way. You know, so I've seen it happen, not, like, anywhere close to me. When I was in, I think, junior high, we all heard about a guy who went to our high school whose girlfriend broke up with him, and I think his parents found him in his bathroom, had her picture in one hand, a gun in the other hand, and his brain all over the wall.
Jeez.
And, I mean, it's like, it's the finality of it. It's like, I guess I'm a thick guy. It impressed me because I'm like, wow, you know, there's no other way. I mean, it's completely over for this guy.
Right.
And, you know, when I'm writing, there's a lot of, you know, feeling in it. And usually I'm kind of I keep to myself, but if you get me writing music, you can find out anything about me on my most inner stuff.
Sure.
And so my songs are so, like, full of feeling that I want other people to feel what I'm singing. And although I've never been, like, suicidal or anything, I thought that this song was, like, I had something to say. I don't know what it was yet. I'll probably listen to it over and over and finally figure it out myself. But I wanted to make, you know, just write something so strong that it would actually move somebody. And the line that says, you know, with the same gun he used, she followed it to hell. You know, there's no other way to say it. You know?
Right.
Of course, you know, my family, I was raised kind of a, not real strict, but, you know, it was a big Christian background. They said, you know, you kill yourself, you go to hell. And so, you know, that had a lot to do with how I worded a lot of it.
Sure.
But I've always been impressed, and I guess there's a lot of people who are just sick like that, but through the years, there have been a lot of country songs about death,
mm-hmm.
but not really a whole lot of suicide ballads, you know?
Sure.
But, and I've actually written more than that. I've got probably too many, and I think if many people heard these things, they'd have me sent to a shrink. But it's just an idea of, in writing that I kind of play with, because it's real touchy. And I like to kind of cross over, you know, boundaries and stuff. You know, people don't talk about feeling themselves in songs.
Sure, and that's the, you know, the heart of country music is, you know, about people's feelings. And, you know, sometimes they're good feelings, but a lot of times they're nasty. There's nasty, you know, nasty feelings. And I think with the music that's being made today, you don't find the trueness of it or the realization, you know, the realistic part of it, to where, you know, you could turn on a Hank Williams song and you can have your heart melt and you can have your, you know, your gut just bust, you know. But you listen to something on the mainstream radio, and at the end of it, you're like, I didn't really feel anything on that except the fact that, you know, the hook line was in it 47 times, and now it's stuck in my head.
Yeah, and then that and the annoying drum beat that you keep, you know. Yeah, there's too much. Everything's been sugar-coated, and they've actually, I think, a lot of people, you know, kind of forsake the whole emotion that goes into songwriting, and they're like, well, it can make me money, so I'll sing this.
Right.
You know, and I think a lot of them, you know, and I've noticed on a lot of the new albums that come out, under songwriter, you know, in the credits, there's like four or five guys that get together and write one song, and I'm like, how can these all four guys share the same feeling, you know? And so, it's more realistic, you know, to me, to hear a song written by one guy by himself, you know, just expressing himself.
Right.
And you know his soul's really in that.
Right, because, I mean, you have four guys. I mean, you put four guys in a room, they can't agree on, all four of them can't agree on anything, but all of a sudden, you know, they can somehow manage to get a song written, and it's all, it's all just, you know, copy.
It becomes, you know, number one song, and you're like, what the hell is that?
Exactly. So, So we've obviously talked, and you write a lot of your original music, and would you say that you're more talented as a writer or a performer, or kind of, is it kind of even?
Well, I've definitely been writing a whole song that I've been performing. I think I started writing when I was 12, just kind of playing with stuff. I don't know. That's the one thing, and I've been asked that before, and I'm like, well, you know, even back in, you know, in junior high, and I was always impressing my English teachers with my writing ability. And it wasn't, you know, we didn't do a lot of, there was no songwriting, but even like, you know, the dumb assignments that we had, I could come up with something, you know, that was pretty impressive. And I guess when I started writing, I've got, you know, some songs that are crap that I hope nobody ever sees. But I've written a song at probably 4 a.m., looked at it, thought, oh, this is crap, gone to sleep, woke up the next day, played through the song, and I'm like, wow, this is one of the best things I've ever heard.
Right.
And so if I can impress myself, I think I'm doing all right, because I sound cocky at times, but I'm probably the worst critic of myself. And I know everybody, you know, it's a cliche, you're your own worst critic, but I can guarantee anybody that I'll tear myself apart before I'll let anybody else say what they think about it.
Right.
Performing, you know, I've seen the audience reaction when I sing, and a lot of the places where I play, you know, they'll offer a videotape of the night's performance, and I'll watch those. And I'd say probably I'm right about even, really. Yeah, I can tell when I do a good job. I've seen myself do a really bad job. I can be a ham on stage. I think everybody feels through that.
But
it's it would be hard to say one or the other. They're probably right about even.
Right about even. And where do you see yourself musically in 5 years from now? And I mean, do you see yourself with a nine to five job and just doing this on the weekends, or are you going to try to make a career of this?
Well, I've had advice on both that. I'm actually in college and working on an education degree, and so I'm more than likely in 5 years I'll be teaching a high school history class.
There you go.
But, and my ultimate plan, you know, really is to do this as much as I can on weekends. And hey, being a teacher, you get the whole summer off, so I can, you know, do what I want to do with my music.
There you go. You can tour in the summer and teach in the winter.
I have been advised by this guy in Gladewater, actually, who told me, you know what you should do? Go finish college, get the degree, and then put it on the top shelf of your closet and get on the road. Because, and I've looked at that, too. I'm like, you know, I can always teach, but people are only going to want to hear a guy sing until he's like, you know, 40, and then when your hair starts turning gray, a lot of them don't care anymore.
Right. So we've kind of touched base a few times already in this interview about your opinion of today's mainstream country, and like I said, the reason for the show is to, you know, give listeners a sample and give them some, you know, finger point and direction on some what I consider underground country or real country, and not the pop bubblegum stuff that's out there now. And I mean, if what do you think about today's mainstream country, and what do you think's going to happen? Is there going to be another outlaw revolution, or is it pretty much there's so much money out there that's being made for the wrong reasons that there isn't going to be another, you know, Willie Nelson and Johnny Cash and Hank Williams Jr. that come along and say, you know, screw you?
Yeah, I think really there's you know, there's a lot of money to be made in Nashville, and there are, I think, too many people that know that. Today's mainstream country or pop country, bubblegum, there's some good music in it, you know, but I kind of resent that they call it country music. You know, if I'm listening to a country radio station, I want to hear country.
Right.
And so my compromise would be, all right, if you'll call it pop country, you'll call it what it is, I can accept it, you know, but quit playing it on country radio. They need to have pop country awards. They need to have pop country stations. They should have pop country music television. I hope and pray someday, you know, maybe if I can have a part of it, would be awesome. But there needs to be a movement of, say, probably 40 or 50 bands that play the same kind of stuff that I do, just rush into Nashville and take the place over.
Right.
You know, that's the only thing. They've got all these, and I don't know who started it. And I know it was back in the 80s when I, you know, you hear on the radio, there's a station out here they say they play nothing but the legends, but you can still hear some of this old synthesized crap that they came out with in the 70s.
Right.
That is starting to kind of border on pop. I hope that it can, you know, I hope somebody can step in and say, hey, you know, let's go this direction with it. Do I think it could happen? I don't know. I think if some of the big guys up there can pull their head out of the clouds and say, you know what, this doesn't sound right, let's do what sounds better, then yeah, but there's a lot of guys wearing blindfolds made out of $100 bills.
Right. Hey, I often say that if Hank Williams Sr. heard some of the music that's being labeled as country music today, I mean, he'd roll over in his grave. I you know what I mean? I think the guys that paved the way for all these people, and he would be embarrassed, I think, personally.
Oh, yeah.
And the people that worked real hard, you know, like Willie Nelson and Johnny Cash, and you know, even the guys way before that, like Hank Williams and like Webb Pearce and stuff. I mean, they worked so hard to get the persona of these hillbilly, you know, uneducated guys. You know, they worked so hard to get that stereotype gone. And to me, we're kind of back to that point where here's just a bunch of guys, you know, singing songs that just they don't have any feeling to them.
Yeah, that's, you know, they try to say that, I heard somebody have the guts to say that, well, I think Hank Williams would like it because he was a pioneer and these guys are pioneers too, which is horse crap.
Right.
These guys, like, you know, it's called country music for a reason. If, you know, the stuff they're playing now is city music. You know, these guys, they took what they had, which it sometimes was a guitar with maybe 5 strings left on it, and some guy's brother-in-law that had a mop and a wash tub that could make it sound like a bass, you know, and that's what they had, and they made music with it. People liked it, you know, it was simple. This stuff nowadays, it is not simple at all, and there's no country to it. You know, I grew up backwoods of East Texas. I know what country is. You know, I went around barefoot most of my childhood, and so these guys that I see now that are my age that are showing up at some of these shows that I do, and they've got on like Abercrombie jeans, jacked up hairdos. You should see these people.
And that's the one you just want to accidentally throw that beer bottle upside the head, you know?
Right. You know, and they're singing this. And I'm like, what is that? And I'm like, oh, it's like, you know, it's cool to check this out. And they're playing stuff to me, and I'm like, you know, that's good that you can play that, but where's that going to get you? You know, it doesn't impress me. And, you know, a lot of the audiences that I play for are, 60-plus years old. They don't want to hear that mess.
Right.
And I think the record companies are targeting the wrong audience. You know, this is like we're trying to sell polka to opera fans.
There you go.
So it doesn't work that way. I mean, you've got an audience, a loyal audience, you know, sell to them. Don't try to reach out, you know, into other territories. And you know, it's cool if they want to expand it, but they're going about it the wrong way. I don't know, you know, if it's the image they want, if it's a different sound they want, but if they're looking for a different sound, they need to go somewhere else, you know, start their own genre.
Right.
But get out of country because, you know, there's guys like myself and Joey and Wayne that are busting our heads trying to keep it real. And we can't because the people that are in charge are just screwing everything up.
Right. You know, and for me, it's funny because, excuse me, I you know, you go to Walmart and you look in the CD section in country and I can't find anything, you know, that of the bands I listen to, like Split Lip Rayfield, like you said, Wayne, you know, forever. It's impossible to find a Hank Williams III one. If they do have it, they have it tucked all the way in the back,
right,
you know, with a big sticker on it, and like with Joey and Porter Hall, Tennessee, and bands like that, that, you know, make such good music, and that's why I wanted to make the show, is because every day Joe Schmo is not going to know where these guys are at or where to find them, you know,
right.
And hopefully, you know, if I have 100 listeners and 10 of them, you know, give you an email or send Joey an email, you know, that's 10 more people that are hopefully someday going to come over to the other side, I guess.
Right. I'd like to see it really, you know, ever since I got turned on to the older style, I was like, you know, this is so much better than what they're shoving down our throats now.
Right.
And a lot of what I've noticed, you know, people are going to take what they get. And, you know, if I was starving to death, you know, I hate broccoli. If somebody's going to feed me broccoli, I'm going to take it, you know.
Right, exactly.
But, and that's what it is new country is, you know, the broccoli of the music industry. Nobody, I mean, they didn't ask for it, but that's all they can get, so they're taking it, you know.
Right. Well, Jake, it's been a pleasure, and like I said, you know, when I saw you, I was very impressed, and I think you have really good sound, and the couple of songs that I've heard that you've written, I mean, they have a lot of feeling, and they hit you in the gut, and they punch you in the face, and that's what real country music is, and I applaud you for what you're doing, and I applaud you for keeping it real, I guess is how they would say it. And keep on doing what you're doing, man. And I really appreciate you being on the show.
Well, I enjoyed it, man. I appreciate what you're doing, too, because there's a lot of people, like you said, you know, they have no idea, you know, what else is going on. And, you know, it's guys like you that are kind of giving us, you know, helping us get a larger audience. And, hey, man, I appreciate it. And I know everybody else does.
All right, man. Thanks a lot.
You bet, man.
All right. All right, it was a pleasure having Jake on the show, and as promised, here's a song called When I Was Dreaming by Jake Penrod. Segment here of It Burns When I Pee episode 2, and just remember, It Burns When I Pee is the only podcast you're going to hear real country music at. I wanted to let everybody know that Hank Williams III is going to be starting up his summer tour here. It looks like July 10th in Little Rock, Arkansas is where he's going to open up the tour, and it's going to go all the way through the middle of August, at least confirmed dates so far. He's going to be playing in Arkansas, Texas, California. Looks like some shows in Missouri and Illinois. So make sure you go to hank3.com, click on the tours, and that way you'll get specific dates and shows. I want to let you all know about that. And also I wanted to let you guys know that go to takecountryback.com. That's takecountryback.com. They've got editorials, blogs, they got videos, and you can buy CDs there, and just got a lot of information on the real country music that's out there today. They were really instrumental in getting spreading the word about our first podcast, so I definitely want you guys to check them out. I also want to let everybody know that we now have a dial-in number. You can leave voicemails to us, tell us the show sucks, tell us it's awesome, tell somebody that you want to hear interviewed on the show, or just say, hey, what the fuck's going on? So whatever you want to do. That number is 309-761-4227. Again, that's 309-761-4227. And it doesn't matter if it's good, bad, whatever you want to say. It's going to be on the shows. We're going to be spreading them out, but every voicemail is going to be played on the show. And last but not least, again, I wanted to give props out to UGT, United Groove Theory. We went and saw this band Saturday night at Kep's Place in Washington, and they kicked ass. They played everything from 80s music, 90s music, rap, country, and they got a little hardcore metal in them too. So they're a great band. They got two lead singers, Robbie and Stacy, and they both put on a great show. We're happy to announce that in the fourth podcast, I think, episode 4, sometime in July, we're going to have UGT in the studio. Yes, they're going to be here at Get Your Hank On Studio. We're going to have three of the band members, and we're going to talk to them, so we're looking forward to that. So why don't you guys go ahead and go to UGTband.com and check them out and check their schedule. They play a lot of shows around Central Illinois. So again, their website is UGTband.com, so check them out. So I just wanted to let everybody know, thank you again for all your support. Let's make podcast number 2 of It Burns But IP even bigger than the first one. And I think we're going to let Cheyenne tell you about the rest of it. Take care, everybody. Thanks a lot.
Episode number 2 of It Burns When I Pee was recorded at Get Your Hank On Studios. We would like to again thank Jake Penrod for being on the show. But most of all, we'd like to thank the fans for listening. Contact us at itburnswhenip86@gmail.com. Or check us out at www.myspace.com/itburnswhenip86. Have a good one, and remember, real men listen to real country and keep their peckers wrapped so it doesn't burn when they pee.